Now come to order. It is 3:18 on Friday, March 6th in Barnes Room 124. Members present are Representatives Hannon, Story, Rasmussen, and myself, Chair Sponholz. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take a moment to silence your cell phones if you haven't done so already. Before we begin, I want to thank Sophia Tenney, the House Labor and Commerce Secretary from Records, and Taylor Kelly from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today, as well as Megan Holland from my office, who is pinch hitting as the committee aide today. We'll be covering two bills in today's hearing, House Bill 93 on military spouse courtesy licenses by Representative Tuck, and House Bill 27 on flame retardants by Representative Tarr. First up, we're going to do HB 93. If you could come forward, Representative Tuck and Michael Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. For the record, Representative Chris Tuck, District 23, South Central Anchorage, also known as the Diamond Business District, and along with me, my staff.
Are you speaking into the microphone?
Mike Mason.
There we go. There we go. That's better. You want to give us a brief recap of the bill?
Sure. Yeah. So what we have before us is House Bill 93, which is the Temporary Courtesy Occupational Licenses. This is pretty much a bill that carries forward from a previous bill passed in 2011 of making sure that we have military spouses have the ability to get their occupational licenses in an expedient way so they can continue practicing in their profession. This really helps out military families when they are being deployed here in Alaska in their transition, as well as making sure that they don't have to, they can practice in the professions that really provide for their families and not have to practice for something less than that to take a long process to get their license with the state.
And if I understand correctly, if I remember correctly, the bill was actually, the underlying bill on which this was based was actually passed in 2011, and what we're asking for in House Bill 93 is actually a report on the subject, since we haven't seen as much progress as we'd expected in this kind of special licensure.
And that's correct, and thank you, Madam Chair, for filling that in for us. But yes, that is the goal, is to get a report back to the legislature to see where our progress is in fulfilling that original bill requirement.
All right, fantastic. We did get a memo from Sarah Chambers, the director of the Division of Corporations Business and Professional Licensing, with the list of all of the list of the temporary professional licenses issued by the division or boards. For everybody to reflect on. Are there any questions for the bill sponsor? Did not everybody get the memo? I think it was emailed out. There we go. All right. Michael Mason to the rescue. All right. Fantastic. All right, so unless there's any questions for the bill sponsor, we're going to go ahead and go to public testimony. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to open it up for public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify on HB 93? All right, seeing no one, is there anybody on the phone who would like to testify on HB 93? I think first up we have Mary Beth Goodman.
Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to present today and share my personal experience. My name is Mary Beth Goodman, and I rise in support of House Bill 93. I am a licensed professional counselor in North Dakota, Nebraska, Colorado, Florida, Missouri, New Mexico, and in Virginia. I also possess my national certification. I have been practicing counseling for over 20 years without fail. I hold special certifications in the following disciplines: trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder, family systems, eating disorders, critical incident stress management, autism, and sensory processing disorders. My resume boasts experience with inner-city psychiatric emergency rooms, residential treatment centers, national acclaimed eating disorder clinics, and veterans rehabilitation nonprofit programs. I have a 20-year job history that impresses the most selective employers. I have been diligent in gathering my continuing education units throughout my years and have amassed well over 750 hours. I am a military spouse. I have been married to my husband for 24 and a half years. We have had 12 formal duty stations in 9 different states. I am a self-proclaimed expert in transferring my professional license. I, however, have been told that I do not qualify to be licensed in Alaska. My board does not issue temporary military spouse reciprocity. I received my degree in 1997. I have been licensed for over 20 years. 20 years ago, my degree met your standards. I have made up for those deficits by continuing my professional education through continuing education units. If you asked an Alaska counselor who had been licensed for 20 years to meet today's board standards, chances are they would not. I am being treated with kindness and courtesy from the counseling board here in Alaska. However, throughout the process, it has been made very clear that my other state licenses and 20 years of clinical experience do not matter. I have quoted the Federal Military Spouse Portability Act, or Federal House Resolution 5683, and even asked if I needed to get legal assistance in navigating this process. They have agreed to meet my application board on March 18th, and I truly hope they grant me reciprocity. I can only speak from my personal experience in the area of mental health counseling. I can tell you that in 20 years of clinical practice in multiple states, my techniques have only changed based on clinical and empirical evidence, not based on where the client lives. After consulting with several other military sponsors and spouses, both in the Anchorage and Fairbanks area, who represent the following professions: teachers, dietitians, nurses, physicians, physical therapists, cosmetologists, and real estate agents, I urge you to consider the following as you take the current bill into consideration. Number one, education. Please be considerate of experience. Even though degrees may be lacking by today's standards, please take into account if they have been actively practicing in their career field. Number two, experience. On-the-job training and years of experience are invaluable in my opinion. I urge you to take work, practicum, and internship experience through supervisor recommendations of competency. Number three, finances. Please consider reducing fees or allowing licensure fees to be waived altogether. The cost of submitting state licensure, verification, transcripts, background screening, and postage makes licensure cost prohibitive. Personally, I have already spent $600 trying to get my license in Alaska, and I'm not done yet. Four, expediency. I am on month 4 of my application process. In those 4 months, I have been unable to provide services to the residents of Alaska. I have not yet bought my home because I am concerned of job security. Quickly establishing licensure and employment for other military spouses would help put money back into your state. We are here to fill vacancies. We are here to contribute to your state. I volunteer 20 hours a month in suicide prevention and suicide education in your communities. I am present in the military mental health community to assist families and veterans who are struggling. I will supervise, educate, and mentor licensure candidates who are graduating from local institutions. I am an active voter, and I am a military spouse. I am not unique, and there are multiple major installations in the state that boast the highest caliber of military spouse. I implore you to value them by passing this bill. In closing, I would like to thank you for allowing me to give this testimony, for giving me the opportunity to leave Alaska better than when I found it, because I know you can relate to that, because that's what you've been called to do.
Are there any questions for Ms. Goodman? Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Goodman, you said that you were told that there are no temporary licensure for your license, correct?
That's correct, for mental health, ma'am.
Okay, so we are looking at data presented to us by the Department of Commerce and Economic Development, oversees the licensing board. In response to our first hearing, they were asked to give us a list of temporary professional licenses that have been issued. They have 3 types under psychology and 1 type under marital and family therapy. Is your license one of those types?
No, I'm a licensed professional counselor.
And what, so I'm not sure what that would show on what board governs that, because we don't, of course, have a professional counsel board. So is that the psychology board?
It is, yes, ma'am.
All right. Yeah,
I was told they discontinued those licenses in 2014.
I think as a point of clarification, I want to ask Ms. Chambers with the division to address the issue of the board in question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is Sarah Chambers, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. And through the chair, Representative Hannon, we do have a board of professional counselors that regulates the counseling profession. I've been taking notes about Ms. Goodman's concern so I can follow up and look into it. But if we had a temporary license for a professional counselor, it would be listed under that board.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm. So are marital and family therapists licensed under the counseling board?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, they have their own board as well.
May I make just follow a broader question? Follow up.
Mm-hmm. How many types of counseling licensors and how many governing boards do we have in Alaska for therapists and counselors?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, there are four boards that are really sort of mental health focused. Marital and family therapists, professional counselors, social work, and psychologists. Mm-hmm. And those encompass all of our strict mental health professions with the exception of behavioral therapists, which are licensed but don't have a board.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm.
So three of those boards that you mentioned do show as issuing temporary professional license, and only the counseling board does not. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I don't have that in front of me, but that was data pulled this week, so it should be accurate.
That is what the memo indicates.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Chambers. And Ms. Goodman, I have a question. You said that you don't meet the Alaska licensure standards. Could you tell us what licensure standard for an LPC that you don't meet, what is, in fact, the barrier for you?
Sure. Present-day licensure requires a 60-hour master's degree. 20 years ago, when I received my master's degree, 48 hours was all that was required. In the board application, it actually states if you received your license prior to July of 2000, you don't need to meet that standard. I am now being told that that is not in the board minutes, in the board rules. It's just kind of on the application, and it shouldn't be there.
All right. Well, I appreciate your bringing that to our attention today. Ms. Chambers is noting this issue as well, and it sounds like there might need to be some administrative clarification that's provided along the way. So thanks for your testimony today. I appreciate your lifting up this issue. We certainly need more licensed professional counselors in the state of Alaska. So thank you very much. All right. Next up.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Next up, we have Tammy Perot. Ms. Perot, are you just available for questions,
sure,
or do you have additional testimony you want to provide today?
I'd like to provide some additional testimony, Chair Sponholz and members of the committee.
All right. Proceed.
The Defense State Liaison Office and the Department of Defense fully support this bill as it provides the opportunity to further identify ways in which we can better support military spouses in the state of Alaska. Occupational licensure is one of the key priorities for the Secretary of Defense and the Department of Defense in improving military quality of life for our military families. As you may know, 68% of our married service members report their spouse's ability to maintain a career impacts their decision to remain in the military. And we just heard a compelling story about how military spouses and military families rely on occupational licensure to go smoothly when they move from state to state. 77% of our military spouses report that they want or need to work, and as many as 34% of our military spouses are required to maintain an occupational license for employment. We think that about half of those, through our studies, are in the healthcare professions. Just a reminder about the demographics in Alaska. Alaska has the second highest number of military spouses of any state, so these truly are your neighbors around every corner. Approximately 11,500 military spouses in Alaska, and about 2,500 to 2,300 of those are licensed spouses. This is a commitment to families that we're making by asking to improve this occupational licensure. You heard a lot in last week about the study done by the University of Minnesota, which has asked to look more carefully at occupational licensure, and we ask for your support on House Bill 93 because this study has seen where other states have not always given the time to look in more closely at this. So this report will bring to light the challenges that the state of Alaska may be facing in making improvements for occupational licensure. We appreciate your support and your consideration of this bill. Subject to your questions.
All right, are there any questions for Ms. Perot? All right, seeing none, thank you for your time today and your testimony. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and, I'm sorry, Ms. Story?
Oh, are you still
Representative
doing,
Story?
Are you still doing public?
I was going to, just okay. About to close public testimony. That's right. All right, and seeing nobody else on the list interested in testifying, I'm going to close public testimony at this time. All right, we received no amendments for this bill. Is there any further points of discussion for the committee? Representative Story?
Thank you. My question had to do with, and I'm not seeing it just at a quick glance, is when is this, if this passes, when would the report be done? It seems like the timeline should be as quickly as possible to find out.
I was just looking
what,
at that, actually.
We could possibly do to be more effective in this area.
On page 2, line 4 of the bill, lines 3 and 4, so the department shall submit the report prepared to the Joint Armed Services Committee on or before the first day of March each year. So we would get the first report next year at this roughly this time for action. All right. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair, or Madam Chair. I guess I want to express on the record a bit of frustration and confusion as to, you know, we heard a very compelling testimony from someone that if we don't ask the follow-up questions, it certainly looks like she would have been licensed. But I have a concern that the report not only answers sort of the questions directly asked, but the underlying clause. So here is a board that doesn't believe it has the authority to vary, and its forms say one thing, its deadlines say another, and the applicant also has concern and confusion. I think additionally we've had some idea that perhaps licensing is being slowed as we've cut back support for all state agencies over the last 5 years. If there isn't the human power to do the processing of the papers, then expediting it maybe moves from a 6-month period to a 4-month period, but it's still not very quick. So I want to make sure that we've got on the record that we want this report not to address just the specific questions defined in it, but sort of analyze the problem of why aren't we able to get there. You know, when the law was passed in 2011, I assume that legislature presumed it addressed the problem that it had seen. And I'm sure that occupational licensing would have had very different level of funding in 2011. And I had sort of perceived that that's been the stall point. But now I'm faced with the idea of we've got four boards governing counseling and therapists, and three are issuing them. So I also want to know how many people are submitting and not being issued them. And I'm not, you know, the report that we're being asked for is how many are being issued. I think we also need to know how many are applying.
Representative Hannon, would you like to amend the bill?
No, I think giving those remarks while the director is in the room helps her understand that point. I don't want to slow down this bill with an amendment.
Well, I think so. I don't want to unnecessarily stall the process, but I do also think that we should ask for what it is that we want. And if, you know, it takes us till Monday to make sure that the bill requests the report that we want,
then that seems like a pretty practical thing to do. We're not going to slow this bill down and impede its passage by waiting till Monday. If you wanted to work on an amendment over the weekend and have it for Monday's meeting, it seems like a very practical thing to do to make sure that we get it right.
Well, I'm wondering if I could offer a conceptual one-word amendment, or I think it's two words.
Okay.
Which would be on line 7 of the first page.
Mm-hmm.
The second clause, it says, so we're asking for previous fiscal year information on temporary licenses. I would applied for and issued. So the two words I would insert would be applied for.
And.
Oh, you're right.
So that's conceptual amendment number one, is to insert applied for and between the words licenses and issued on page 1, line 7.
Discussion.
Go ahead, proceed.
Thank you. Through the chair, that might just get us a number that says how many that were applied for and issued. It doesn't tell us how many were applied for and not issued.
Mm-hmm. So, first of all, just procedurally, I need to object for the purposes of discussion so that we can be doing this.
Okay, so let's change. How about if in my conceptual manner it is applied for or issued, so we would see the difference in the math.
Well, I think if we say applied for and issued, actually you get both the number that were applied for and the number that were issued, and you do the difference. The difference is which ones were not accepted, right? And I think there's a sort of there's a simple math there issue. Representative Tech, would you like to come forward and give any your response to the suggestion?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Representative Chris Tuck, District 23. When we look under E, we have 1, 2, 3, 4 pieces of information that we're looking for specifically. One mm-hmm. of those line items is the number and type of licenses that have been issued.
Mm-hmm.
I think we just add another line item, the number and type of licenses that have been applied for. That way we get both. So we have the number, but we're also looking at the information. But we also remember in 2, which is on line 10, item number 2 is progress made towards implementing regulations for these licenses. The goal is really is to see where we're at. And if it's helpful to have the number of applicants that are there, mm-hmm. then we should add that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that does help strengthen the bill.
Mm-hmm.
But to address Representative Story's concern that we just don't want a number. We also want additional information to see where we're getting there. I think mm-hmm. I think the other items helps along with that.
So do we need to amend the conceptual amendment to amend line 13, which is bullet number 3, the number and type of licenses that have been applied for and issued?
That
was
for me.
If I may, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. on that one, I almost think it needs to be an additional line, because the way that would be crafted in language would tell me mm-hmm. applied for and issued. That's almost just saying as issued, because you have to apply for it before it's issued.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That makes sense?
That's where
so I'm we can not, say, I'm not a huge fan of doing amendments verbally. If it's possible right. that we could take an at ease, work on a physical amendment, a physical conceptual amendment, so we can all see exactly what it is that we're talking about, I think that would be helpful for me, if that's all right with everybody.
And also, Madam Chair,
mm-hmm.
With the chair's wishes right now, but I'd be more than happy to work with Representative Hannon as this bill moves forward to make sure they get the language right, if everybody feels confident that would happen. Otherwise, at your will, Madam Chair.
I'm absolutely comfortable with that. I think that the intent is clear. This is the last committee of referral before it goes to the floor. So we can either do it here or we can do it on the floor. And it seems that it's a little bit.
I assume, but I'm speculating as a freshman, mm-hmm. that it's going to be easier to do it here than on the floor.
My preference probably would be to do it on in committee rather than on the floor.
And we do, we will, if it passes the floor, go through the Senate as well. But there'll be opportunities in other committees.
Okay, so back up to the original question, Representative Hannon.
So, Madam Chair.
Chair Von Holtz.
Would your recommendation be that we hold the bill to Monday and we have a written amendment?
That would be my preference. All right. So we're going to go ahead at this point in time. Would you like to withdraw your conceptual amendment at this time?
I withdraw my conceptual poorly worded amendment.
I would not say that it was poorly worded, but I think that having a little bit of time to work out the details, make sure we're getting it right, doing it on Monday and moving out of committee on Monday evening will accomplish the mission and won't slow down the bill considerably. So thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
All right. And with that, we're going to go ahead and set this bill aside. And we will take it up on Monday. The amendment deadline should be noon on Monday for this. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Tuck, for your flexibility. All right. Next up, we've got HB 27. That was a little messy sausage on Friday afternoon. Representative Tarr and Ms. Hart, welcome to House Labor and Commerce. You want to go ahead and put yourself on the record and introduce your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Garen Tarr from District 19 in Anchorage.
I'm Carla Hart, staff to Representative Tarr.
Thank you. And three of you have heard this bill recently, or not so recently, but previously in the House Resources Committee, but do want to kind of focus in on the labor and commerce issues. So there's a little bit of the health information in here, but also want to just be thinking about sort of the jurisdiction of this committee, and so come in and specifically reference a couple of those things. I start with this slide. Just there's a couple of slides just to give us a little bit of context, because sometimes the question comes up of why we would have a state law on one of these chemical policies. And so these first couple slides talk a little bit about the federal context. We do have federal laws that address some of these, but if you look at when these federal laws were passed, they're very dated legislation, and our scientific understanding has significantly improved and deepened over these many decades. More recently, a reflection of that is this 2008 Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act, where we set children as the benchmark for safety. Previously, and folks might be familiar with this kind of in our everyday lives, you may have heard, for example, when medications developed, that previously the tendency had been to use as the average person the 150-pound white male. But that doesn't really work when you're looking at physiological impacts for women, people of different race or ethnicities, and especially children who metabolize chemicals and things in their body a lot more quickly and have a lot more hand-to-mouth kind of activity just because of them being closer to the floor and touching everything. So this was a pretty big deal when this law passed, because what it said was we had to go back and retest some of these chemicals using children's safety and children's health as the benchmark. But you can see here we are more than 12 years since that bill has passed, and they're still working on the regulations for that. So that kind of sort of sets us up for this more recent reform here. This is the more comprehensive Toxics Control Substance Act. This did improve the way we will manage these chemicals at the federal level, but my point in kind of highlighting all of these is just that much more remains to be done and much more remains to be learned, and that's really what has inspired folks like myself to work on these issues at the state level, to try and use our resources to understand what's happening and then push for the change to kind of move this along, because sometimes at the state level we can just accomplish things that are a little bit harder when you're trying to do the whole nation. So the worker health safety concerns due to exposure to these chemicals include this broad list of things that any of us would be concerned about: cancer, reproductive health, endocrine disruption, respiratory, neurodevelopmental. And the big thing for us to remember in talking about these things is that all of us have different genetics and all of us have different exposures. So what makes regulating these chemicals a challenge is often you're trying to create a strict causational relationship where you were exposed to this chemical and you got cancer as a result of that. That's very difficult to do because we don't test on humans, because we all have different genetics, and because our exposures are all different. And so when we do the work, you know, we see through the research that any number of these health effects, adverse health effects, can be the outcome. But why it's different from person to person is because our own genetics are different. And when we map the Human Genome Project, for example, one of the things we try to learn is, you know, what things are in your sort of genetic map, your own personal genetic map, versus what things are caused by environmental exposure, versus what things are actually a combination of the two. So sometimes, and we'll talk about this with endocrine disruption, these chemicals that we're exposed to just because of our own personal bodies, right, will have an impact to us that wouldn't happen to another person. The three ways for exposure, and we'll talk about these more specifically when we look at the kind of worker health safety and the children's issues, but absorption, inhalation, and eating. So in our case, we're more interested in the absorption and inhalation components of this. Sometimes there's eating as well. So that brings us to the chemical that's regulated through this piece of legislation, the flame retardants, as the kind of common terminology, the PBDE. References the chemical terminology polybrominated diphenyl ethers. And these are products that are listed there, used in a variety of things that we're around every single day, from things in our home to things in our cars to the plastics that we use, you know, like the computers and everything here. And if you're familiar with PCBs that have, you know, over the decades had a lot of attention in terms of long-lasting impacts and cleanup, these are structurally similar to those. And why we talk sometimes, and you'll see in the legislation, about regulation not of one specific chemical, but now we've moved to regulating a family of chemicals, is because these are all so closely related, that what was happening before is, as there were efforts to prohibit the use of one, then one that was very closely related would replace it, but that very closely related one still brought health concerns. Mm-hmm. And so now we're trying to look a little more comprehensively so that we can say, okay, you know, these are all so similar that we need to be concerned and look for alternatives for all of them. The reason we're so concerned about these is this issue of bioaccumulation. And, you know, the PFAS issues have been in the news, and we're going to be talking next week about those. This is another flame retardant chemical, but the bioaccumulation, I think, is an issue that's really come out with the concerns about that. So that just means the more you're exposed to these, the more that are going to be found in your body. So some things you metabolize and release. If you think of taking vitamin C when you're not feeling well, right, there's not a problem if you take too much vitamin C. Your body just gets rid of the excess. But some other chemicals don't act like that in our body. And, in fact, the way they bioaccumulate means they sort of add up and become more present. And so there are a lot of different health impacts related to that. And as a real worker safety issue, this exposure to these flame retardants is the leading cause of cancer in firefighters. Why we use these flame retardants, if you just look back to this timeline, and I think, you know, this is one of those things, again, why I think it's important to look in the context of these federal laws and what we've learned over these times since some of those laws were passed so long ago. Notice that first TSCA was passed in 1976, right around the same time that original flammability standard was passed. But over time, you know, what you can see is, as we've learned more, there's been this big push to, you know, remove these chemicals from things we use. And what's happened is we've developed new products. It used to be that house fires, for example, were a big issue related to cigarette smoking. But now those products have been changed, so they're self-extinguishing, and we don't have the house fire problem. There are alternatives that can be used to make the furniture that, for example, the wool is naturally flame retardant. So, you know, if you're looking at making a rug or other car seats and things like that, you know, wool is a good replacement material that is naturally flame retardant. So over these years, you know, the need for these has been reduced, or some might even suggest kind of eliminated, because they're alternatives, because we've sort of changed some of those lifestyle habits. We should be at much lower risk for for fire and in turn for the need for these chemicals. There's a couple of slides here just to sort of show that how we are exposed. And one of the things we like to talk about is just thinking about in Alaska how, given our temperatures, particularly in more northern areas of the state, we spend significant amount of our time kind of cooped up, and we don't always have the windows open, a lot of good air exchange and things like that. So, you know, any of the stuff that's happening sort of from exposure into your home could be somewhat intensified because of our lifestyle. But this just shows some of the furniture or electronics that might have these products in them. And then what happens over time is as those products deteriorate, sort of, you know, unknown to us, if you will, but the dust that's being kind of dropped to the floor, and you can see the child crawling around there, they're exposed to those because of that kind of pathway and where they're at. Some of the other kind of exposure routes, specifically looking at children's health here, list some of these products. Of course, these are also things that we would all be around, but them more closely if they're sleeping or napping on them. But when we think about the worker health safety piece of it, remember that any of these products, once a home or business is on fire and they're combusting, would be combusting those chemicals, and that's where the firefighters are exposed. And just these last couple slides here to talk about endocrine disruption, that's one of the things we list there. And we talk a little bit more about this again in the Resources Committee as sort of on the DEC side of things, but just wanted to include these, thinking of the worker safety part of it. And this is kind of true of more than just this particular set of chemicals, but just to kind of give a little bit of a basic introduction, the easiest way to describe it is thinking of a lock and key relationship where the chemicals that are naturally in our body are pretty specific for the function they're supposed to have, and that's just our body's built-in way of making sure things happen correctly. But unfortunately, some of these chemicals in the environment that get into our body mimic those natural hormones, and our body doesn't have a way of distinguishing between the two. And what happens in the case of these endocrine disruptors is it can cause the hormone system, our endocrine system, to either produce too much of a hormone, too little of a hormone, or at the wrong time. And any of those outcomes are not good based on what it's supposed to be doing. And when that happens, you can see all these endocrine disrupting chemicals could have a number of biological impacts on our human health. And again, it's very difficult to say, you know, exactly which person would be impacted in what way, because we all have those different genetics and that different exposure. But a huge number of concerning adverse health outcomes. So, you know, what are our policy solutions? We can restrict the use of these known chemicals of concern. We can restrict the use of the possible substitutes. We can collect and conduct research and collaborate with other states. And all of those things are a part of this legislation. So we've tried to move forward with what we think will be a proven sort of policy solution. I will say there are 22 current policies in 14 states. Under consideration in 43 adopted policies in 14 states. So a lot of work going on across the country on this, and a lot of the bills look a lot like the one that we have here. And I would like to mention that the Anchorage Assembly passed an ordinance. Our piece of legislation mirrors that ordinance fairly closely, not 100% exactly, but it's pretty close, and there are some pieces we could talk about related to that. And I just want to point to the huge number of letters of support. If this feels a little deja vu for anyone, it's because this bill has been in the works for over a decade. There have been, I think, 11 different iterations of this legislation. So many public health and firefighter organizations and children's health organizations and organizations that serve Alaskans with developmental disabilities, so many of them have written and written and written. You know, some of them are the more recent legislation. Some are from the bill I had in the prior legislature, but the bill itself really hasn't changed. And so, you know, we just include that huge number of letters to show how diverse the support is for this legislation. And more recently, there was a new letter from Chief Tucker, from the Firefighters Association. And I hope that made its way into your packet. But we have firefighters who are dying of really rare cancers. And, you know, I know that we're all people that honor our first responders and the people who put themselves in harm's way to keep people safe. So it's really, you know, just really sad after they've served in that capacity that their lives are being cut short because of that work. I think I want to stop there and see if there are any questions, and kind of hope I gave a little bit on the health information, but again, notice knowing that you're the Labor and Commerce Committee, wanted to really stress on the points about worker safety, and also as it relates to commerce, that there are safe alternatives. And lastly, I guess I'll just say in that packet, there are also some letters of support from furniture manufacturers. The way we talk about these kind of chemicals and the use is, when California makes a change, it kind of impacts the entire West Coast because they dominate with a number of consumers. So there's a lot of work kind of trending in this direction. And like I say, the Anchorage Assembly had previously passed that ordinance as well. So a statewide policy seems very achievable at this point. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I would actually like it if you could do a brief sectional for us.
So the first section is just findings, and this, I think, in part reflects how long this issue has been before you, or before the prior legislatures as well. The second section addresses the chemical compounds that are being prohibited. And again, as Representative Tarr said, it's looking at the family of compounds and not specific named compounds, because of a concept called whack-a-mole, where they change one bond in a chemical and have something that has a new name and continues to be harmful. Mm-hmm. Under the exemption section, we've exempted used and secondhand upholstered furniture. So if you already own furnishings and you're reselling it, it would not be a subject to this law unless someone is rebuilding the furniture. So if you have someone who has a business and they rebuild and reupholster furniture, then it would be covered by it. We exempt products or components of products for motor vehicles, watercraft, aircraft, and other vehicles, and products that are primarily used outside of the home. And in this particular section, there is a little bit of lack of clarity. We removed, with a committee substitute, child seats were specifically named in the original version of the bill. Mm-hmm. We removed that with the understanding that a child seat is primarily used outside of the home. The industry in their letters to us repeatedly are saying that child seats are covered by it. So they know more than us, perhaps, that parents use child seats in the home a lot as well. So the industry is repeating that they see that they're still covered by this bill, even though it was our intent in removing the listing. The civil penalty is $500 a day for a violation. There is no enforcement mechanism in this bill. There's no funding for anyone to do enforcement. So the civil penalty would really be partly symbolic and partly if at some point in the future someone created an enforcement mechanism. The participation in the Interstate Chemicals Clearinghouse, this authorizes the Department of Environmental Conservation to participate. There is a cost for participation, and so we remove the requirement that they participate to bring the fiscal note down and allow a future legislature to appropriate funds if the state feels like they can afford it at another date. And then the definition section, I think, is pretty straightforward.
Chair Spondholz?
Yeah. Representative Hannon?
If I may, I'd like to ask a question.
Go ahead.
Can you tell me, Ms. Hart, in section 18-31640, the Interstate Clearinghouse, what the cost to participate in that is, and expand a little bit on the kinds of information that it gives?
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, I'll speak up here because it's something I've been involved with probably over the last decade or so. So there are some, before the TSCA reform bill was passed, that had been a multi-year effort. And what was working, there were many states and not small nonprofits trying to work together on that. And there was a recognition that there needed to be better collaboration between states because that research that I mentioned in the early part of the presentation is so expensive and difficult to do, and most states just don't have the capacity, not just Alaska, to go out and, you know, conduct multiple public health research studies. So the idea is that by participation in this clearinghouse, you could better, you know, strategize and think about use of funds. And if you knew that three other states were doing something about exposure in children, then maybe your state would look to something in the elderly, or, you know, you try to kind of make sure that everybody's work was complementary. And the science is always changing, and, you know, some universities have research components. And so, you know, just the idea that we could all benefit by having this interstate clearinghouse, and that, you know, that the information could be shared a little more broadly. It's ebbed and flowed over the years. Some states have really participated, put a lot of resources in it, and those tend to be the bigger states. But then smaller states and less funded, you know, with less funding, states can really benefit from having access to that. So we had worked, for example, with the folks over at DEC. If Alaska participates, you know, we'd have some of the DEC folks, maybe from the pesticide program or other permitting or something, would, you know, be the participants to benefit from that knowledge and sharing.
Follow-up? So it's not a fixed cost, is what I'm hearing you say.
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, no. It had been previously based on a number of, like, population size, overall state budget, all these things to kind of incorporate the diversity of participation.
Follow-up?
Mm-hmm.
In most state, I mean, so when you're doing research, our state agencies typically don't do research, so is it, in some states, is it their university system participating in the clearinghouse, doing the research, and,
you know? Through the chair to Representative Hannon, yes, but some states are actually doing more of their own. And I would say in Alaska, for example, through Department of Health and Social Services and their epidemiology work, sometimes it's not original research, but they use other people's original research to produce those bulletins, for example. So Alaska, I would say, doesn't do quite as much as I've seen in other places, but some states, like their, you know, Division of Public Health might engage in a research project. If you think back, for example, to Representative Paul Seaton, and he had a big concern about vitamin D, he was trying to, you know, create a program where newborn babies would all be tested for vitamin D levels. Well, you know, those are the kind of things that you, you know, you might see other states do, not relative to vitamin D in this context, but you might have, you know, testing for certain people in certain professions, that kind of thing. So people are really needing information on these decisions, and just unfortunately sometimes there's just not enough of it or not enough studies, and you know, when you're having to balance the health or environmental impacts versus the business impacts, that's where this information becomes really important.
Representative Tarr, is there anybody in the state of Alaska that's at the University of Alaska, for example, that's currently studying the flame retardants?
Representative Sponholz, I don't believe so. More broadly, we were very sad when we lost research capacity around endocrine disruptors more broadly. Mm-hmm. When, oh my goodness, I can't believe I'm not thinking of his name right now, from the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Dr. Frank von Hippel.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. A couple of others have since left. So we have had some incredible research capacity through our university professors, and that's one of the reasons I find it very concerning what's happening with our universities, because Mm-hmm. We're losing some of that talent. And then, in turn, some of the National Science Foundation or National Institutes of Health, who tend to be big funders for public health and environmental research, and those dollars are going to.
Dr. Von Hippel is an internationally recognized expert who is actually from Alaska, grew up in Anchorage, and we were so excited when we were able to get him to come back to UAA to work in Alaska, and since was recruited to Arizona State University, I believe, and it's a big loss for our state when one of our own takes his internationally recognized expertise and goes to another state. But I noticed that the bill allows the DEC to participate in the Interstate Chemicals Clearinghouse to learn about flame retardant chemicals, but there's no cost associated with that. So we're saying that there's no cost associated with it. We're not actually contributing any information to it. We're just allowing them to be able to pull information from it.
Representative Sponholz, it's this has been a thing that we've had in there because we really wanted to be able to participate and benefit from that kind of collaboration. But because the fiscal note issue, because we're trying to have something at least move forward, if we can't seek additional funding at this time, then, we've sort of given in and said, this is an important step forward. Let's not delay this important step because we don't at this time have the funding to fully participate. So it's permissive, and there's some flexibility within their budget if they had funding. I think it would strengthen their ability to reach out to that group to know that we had put this in legislation. But I don't have exact information, and I can certainly follow up on whether we would be able to get out of it as much as we could if we don't also put in.
Yeah.
That's kind of how it was structured before. Like I say, it was based on a sort of like an overall state budget, population size kind of input.
Okay, so there's kind of a membership fee or a user fee that's associated for individual states, but in order to maintain cost neutrality on this, we're giving them permission to participate, but not allowing them to become full members.
Yes, that is true, Madam Chair, at this time.
All right. Are there any other questions for the bill's sponsor, Representative Story?
Yes, thank you, Chair. Through the Chair, Representative Tarr, have you had many conversations with furniture manufacturer owners in Alaska and how this bill, if passed, will it mean for them and any steps they will have to take?
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Story, I'm going to ask Ms. Hart for some help just pointing out these letters. In the packet that you have, we have a letter of support from Scanhome, for example. That's an Alaska-based business. We also have, I know, another letter here from the Sustainable Furnishings Council and their executive director. And Ms. Hart, I think, can help us with filling in the one I'm forgetting. I know we have a few.
This one on the second page is the sustainable furniture one.
Through the chair, the owner of Sadler's Furniture has testified and given support in the past. We had him online to testify in an earlier schedule. We've had a few reschedules with this meeting. So we were pursuing the owner of Sadler's Furniture in Anchorage, and he has done a bunch of work all the way back to 2011 when I was working on this bill in the Senate. And he has done a lot of work in looking and finding who is providing furnishings that meet the requirement. And now with Anchorage having moved to their regulation, he's finding I think the quote that I got was that he's finding it difficult to buy furniture that wouldn't meet the regulation in Anchorage now because of the West Coast, Oregon, or not Oregon, Washington and California have both passed laws that are encouraging the manufacturers to manufacture furniture that's compliant with this.
And Ms. Hart is referencing the fact that we had to cancel Wednesday's meeting because we had a COVID-19 briefing, which
seem to be an appropriate place for the legislature to invest its energy and time right now. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair. And I think some of my deja vu is because we serve on resources. So
we've already heard this. Yes.
Resources.
Yeah, that's right.
But in, I think Representative Story asked about Alaska manufacturers. My recollection from our hearing and resources is that there are no Alaskan furniture manufacturers. But the wholesalers have explained, mm-hmm. or businesses that sell furniture have explained, they have lots of wholesale options that come into compliance because California has that standard. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, if I could just thank Representative Hannon for that clarification. That is true, and pardon us for not being more specific. We just, yeah, we're not a big manufacturing state. So this is at the manufacturing level in terms of what the chemical additives are when they're put into the furniture. But we do have the support from some of those Alaska retailers. And those are some of the biggest retail outlets in Anchorage, at least. Here, there's Southeast Furniture. I know there's, and I think we've talked to them before. I'm trying to remember. But those are certainly some of the larger ones in Anchorage.
Perhaps we could have the gentleman that you referenced earlier send in a letter or an email with that. All right, and there is a couple of people who are queued up for invited testimony, so I want to make sure to make time for them. So if there are no more questions for the bill sponsor and her aide, we will let them back up and make some space for Sue Chan, who is with Alaska Community Action on Toxics. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Chair Svanholz and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Sue Chan, and I am the Civic Engagement Coordinator for Alaska Community Action on Toxics and a lifelong Alaskan. I believe that access to clean air, clean water, and safe shelter is a basic human right. Growing up in Alaska, I've always felt truly blessed, believing that Alaska was pristine lands. I've now come to realize that Alaska in reality has many contaminated sites and is at high risk to exposure from global contaminants due to the way chemicals concentrate in northern areas. Today, it's not just our outdoor environments. Many harmful pollutants have found their way into our homes and our workplaces. Flame retardants are one of many of them. They say flame retardants are the new lead because of the way they harm our health, including learning and developmental disabilities, cancers, and reproductive impairment even at very low levels. They are widely found from our mattresses, our carpeting, to our television set. They are even found in children's products and toys, which they have no business to be in. And the name flame retardant is a misnomer because they are proven to be ineffective at providing fire safety benefits in our homes. The scientists who study these flame retardant chemicals and firefighters who battle house fires can attest to this, and they have testified in support of our bill in previous years. In March of 2019, the Anchorage Assembly unanimously passed the Protecting the Health of Children and Firefighters Ordinance, a landmark ordinance preventing the use of harmful flame retardant chemicals in children's products, furniture, and mattresses. We ask that you pass HB 27, a substantively similar bill to ensure the protection of the health of all Alaskans. The Alaska State Legislature also has a responsibility to protect our firefighters and our taxpayer dollars. Science has shown certain flame retardant chemicals increase the risk of cancer in our firefighters, and the cost to healthcare for firefighters with cancer can cost millions of dollars per person, not to mention the pain and suffering for their family and community. Death for firefighters and first responders has a large social cost, plus death benefits that can and should be provided to survivors. Inaction will cost the taxpayers in the long run. And this is an opportunity for the legislature to take the moral high ground in protecting the health of our children and firefighters who are the most vulnerable among us and to prevent harm to everyone in this community. HB 27 received broad support from the firefighting community, healthcare providers, scientists, parents, teachers, and children's health advocates. We ask you to pass HB 27 during this legislative session. Thank you very much for all of your hard work, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions for Ms. Chan? All right, seeing none, thank you very much. Next up, we're going to go to Tom Westcott with Alaska Professional Firefighters, who is on the off-net.
Thank you, Chair Sponholz, members of the committee. My name is Tom Westcott. I'm president of the Alaska Professional Firefighters. I'm calling in today to support in support of HB 27. The Alaska Professional Firefighters supports this bill and encourages passage. HB 27 would work to ban chemicals proven to be dangerous to firefighters and the community, such as PBDE flame retardants. Excuse me. Our organization represents 500 firefighters across Alaska, and we support this bill and look forward to passage. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Mr. Westcott? Mr. Westcott, this is Chair Sponholz. I am curious, could you describe for us what you know about sort of the relative efficacy of flame retardants at actually slowing the progress of fire?
Through the chair, I don't want to come off as a chemical expert. What I do know from firefighting is that everything will burn eventually when it's heated to a certain point, and you know you can burn steel. What we do know is there's other ways to achieve the same results, and one of the things Ms. Chan talked about earlier was cancer in firefighters.
Mm-hmm.
We see cancer at a much higher rate than the general population, and one of the reasons is the products of combustion that burn and that we're exposed to, even when we have all of our gear on, through skin absorption, the dioxins and furans that are released from these flame retardants, and unfortunately, I've seen it firsthand here in Alaska with firefighters getting cancer. So as far as the flame retardants, the effectiveness, I think the thing is there's better ways to do it, and the dangers that these chemicals the dangers that they present, and especially when they burn and we enter a burning structure and are exposed to them through inhalation and skin absorption, that there's better ways to achieve the same goals.
Yeah, we've heard in a hearing on HB 84, which is a workers' comp bill regarding the presumptive illness for first responders, about the dangers of flame retardants and higher rates of cancers amongst firefighters and other first responders. Could you describe you said there are better ways to slow fire. Could you describe these for us?
Well, I think in earlier testimony, I believe it was Representative Tarr, she talked about, the cigarette industry. It was very common, about, say, 20 years into my career, but even from the stories from the past, and I think Alaska adopted the safer cigarettes during my career. Mm-hmm. But we don't see the same instances of cigarettes starting fires that we saw before. I think wool was brought up as a natural preventative fire retardant, not fire retardant, but as a method. And there are other types of flame retardants, that as long as they're tested to ensure that there's not this secondary harm that we're doing, we'll find a way to replace or recreate the value that we see in flame retardants in other ways that are safer and better. Those examples that were brought up in earlier testimony are just a few ways.
All right. Are there any other questions for Mr. Westcott? All right, Representative Story.
Through the chair, thank you, Mr. Westcott, for the information and the letter that we have here. It is making me think about what the Fire Chiefs Association does for prevention in making families aware of these chemicals that are possibly in products, and what efforts are there currently to educate all of us about things to be aware of.
Through the chair, I'm not sure I'm the person to tackle that question. The fire chiefs are a separate group. You know, our group, I guess, where we work to bring attention to this is in working with, you know, ACAT to bring this forward, this important issue forward, and you know, bring it to the attention of the body that can, you know, influence change, and that's the legislature.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for your testimony today, Tom. All right. So thanks to everybody who testified on the bill today. We're going to go ahead and set this bill aside for further action today. On Monday, we're going to bring forward and take action on a committee substitute for House Bill 235, the TVEP reauthorization bill. We'll hear an initial presentation on House Bill 301 on apprenticeships by Representative Ledoux. And we will have our first hearing on Senate Bill 52 by Senator Peter Michicki on the Title IV rewrite for an initial presentation by stakeholders and the bill sponsor. We'll be spending quite a bit of time on Senate Bill 52 and the Title IV rewrite over the next week and a half. On Wednesday, we're going to hear two bills. We'll hear House Bill 94 on a vaping product excise tax by our own representative, Sarah Hannon, and Senate Bill 52 again on Title IV rewrite for a sectional overview and other invited testimony. On Friday, we'll consider four bills. We will take up House Bill 91 on naturopaths by Representative Johnston. The amendment deadline for this bill is the close of business on Thursday. We'll be looking to the will of committee and considering amendments on Friday. HB 301 on apprenticeships by Representative Ledoux will consider amendments and look to the will of the committee. Once again, the amendment deadline will be the close of business on Thursday. HB 27, which we heard today, will hear public testimony and look to the will of the committee at that time. As referenced earlier, the amendment deadline will be the close of business on Thursday. And then HB 146 on auto dealers by Representative Klayman will be holding an initial hearing on that legislation. And it is now, is it 3:25 or is it 4:25? Thank you. It is 4:25, and this hearing of the House Labor and Commerce Committee is now adjourned.